You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, folks. Just a quick announcement. I'm trying to grow our listenership, so I hope you'll share Kick-Ass News with two of your friends this week, or better yet, share it with all of your friends on your social media. And if you'd like to pitch in and become a part of what I'm doing here, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickAssNews. Whatever you can do to support the podcast is appreciated, and it shows me that you value this little show that I put out every week. Thanks for listening, and now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. You've probably heard someone in conversation describe a person they know as a real mensch. It's kind of the Jewish version of a stand-up guy. The Merriam-Webster's dictionary defines a mensch as a person of integrity and honor. But if you go back far enough to the German-Yiddish origins of the word, the literal translation is quite simply a human being. To be a mensch is to be the kind of human being we were all meant to be, but far too often fall short of. You might not have heard the name Shep Gordon. But among his many famous friends and clients in the entertainment industry, this legendary manager, agent, and producer is known far and wide by the nickname Supermensch. It's the title of his new book, They Call Me Supermensch, and also the title of a 2014 documentary about him by his friend, actor, and comedian Mike Myers. Mike Myers recounts how he met Shep Gordon on the set of Wayne's World, and a little while later, when Mike Myers' father died and he was at his lowest point, he asked if he could spend a weekend at Shep's house in Hawaii. He ended up staying for 2 months, and every day Shep Gordon cooked for him, talked to him about life, and nurtured him through his roughest time until he was whole again and ready to re-enter the world. Mike Myers isn't alone. Everyone in Hollywood has a Shep Gordon story. Whether it's Michael Douglas or Willie Nelson or Tom Arnold or Wolfgang Puck, anyone who knows him says at some time in their life, when they were at their lowest or needed someone to be there, Shep Gordon was the guy who stood up for them, took care of them, or made their life better for having known him. It's a philosophy of service and kindness that has guided the legendary career of this music manager, movie producer, and culinary hero his whole life. Over the years, Shep Gordon has befriended everyone from Janis Joplin to Betty Davis and Salvador Dali to the Dalai Lama. He launched the career of his first client, the Alice Cooper Band, 47 years ago, and he remains his manager and best friend to this day. Shep Gordon has also managed the music careers of Luther Vandross, Blondie, Teddy Pendergrass, Anne Murray, and Pink Floyd, as well as stars like Groucho Marx and Raquel Welch. He founded one of the first independent film companies long before Miramax, producing cult classics and award-winning art house films, and launching the careers of directors like Ridley Scott and Alan Rudolph. Along the way, Shep Gordon literally invented the celebrity chef and brought cooks like Wolfgang Puck, Nobu Matsuhisa, Daniel Boulud, Alice Waters, Mario Batali, and Emeril Lagasse out of the kitchen and into the homes of millions of Americans. He's become a master cook himself, having trained under his close friend, the late Michelin-starred chef Roger Verger. And these days, Shep Gordon says cooking for others and sharing good times with friends is the thing that brings him the greatest joy. He writes about it in his new memoir, They Call Me Supermensch, a backstage pass to the amazing worlds of film, food, and rock and roll. Today I sit down with him to talk about his remarkable career and the principles that have guided his life. We'll talk about what originally brought him to Los Angeles and how checking into the right motel and a little advice from Jimi Hendrix launched his career in the music business. He'll talk about some of the stunts he came up with to get attention for his very first client, Alice Cooper, and how an incident with the band and a very young Cameron Crowe inspired a classic scene in the movie Almost Famous. He talks about taking on the notorious Chitlin circuit while managing R&B singer Teddy Pendergrass, and how he helped liberate chefs like Wolfgang Puck and Emeril from being treated like the help to becoming celebrities and a billion-dollar industry. Shep Gordon shares his rules for what he calls compassionate business. He talks about the high price of fame, and he reveals who was the biggest diva he ever worked with. Plus, living a life of kindness and cooking for the Dalai Lama. Coming up with entertainment legend and lovable supermensch, Shep Gordon, in just a moment. Today I'm joined by legendary music manager, film agent, producer, chef, and super mensch, Shep Gordon. Someone finally convinced him to write his memoirs. It's all in his new book called They Call Me Supermensch, a backstage pass to the amazing worlds of film, food, and rock and roll. Shep Gordon, thanks for meeting with me.
Aloha, nice to see you.
First of all, I have to ask, who gave you the nickname Supermensch?
Mike Myers is the one who came up with, I think, where he came up with it from. And I've never really talked to him about it, and I really should. But I had the honor of meeting Norman Lear about 20 years ago. And my dad loved Norman Lear shows. My dad passed away. And when I met Norman, I said this would be like the high point of my father's life if he knew that I even knew Norman Lear. And Norman sent me a note after we met, and he called me a mensch. Huh. And I always kept that note thinking my dad would be so proud. And when Mike started the movie, he asked me if there was a tidal wave, because I live on the ocean, what three things would I take from the house? Which was a great question, made me really think, and one of them was the letter. And I think when he read the letter, he came up with the name Supermensch. That's my guess.
Yeah. For anyone who's not Jewish, the term mensch
means... Are there people not Jew, really?
What's that?
These people not Jewish.
Well, not in Hollywood, I guess. Not where we are, but for my parents in Texas, a mensch is, I guess the definition, if you go into Webster's, is a person of integrity, a good yeah. man.
I mean, I think in the colloquial for the Jewish is, it's just a good man.
Well, yeah. Because
someone who makes the right choices.
Yeah, and it's funny because I've also seen the definition, a human being.
Yes.
Which I think is perfect because it's...
It's what a
how
human being
we're
should
supposed
be.
To be.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
How
yeah.
we're supposed to treat each yeah. other. Now, you've managed a long list of stars from Alice Cooper, Blondie, Anne Murray, Luther Vandross, the Gypsy Kings, Kenny Pendergrass, Pink Floyd for, I think, 9 days, you said. Groucho Marx, Raquel Welch, then celebrity chefs, which didn't even exist before you, like Wolfgang Puck, Nobu Matsuhisa, Roger Verger, Emeril Lagasse, Alice Waters. And you seem to be universally adored. Everyone seems to say that you're a guy who always does the right thing, you're honest, you're kind. What are some of the principles that you do business by and also live by?
Yeah, I think I don't really separate my business from my life. Some of my principles are, I think at the starting point when I start a relationship with an artist, most people try and create a contract between each other, which immediately puts you in an adversarial position. So you're no longer in the friend category. You're now an adversary. I never signed contracts.
Never?
Never. I mean, I signed. I always signed contracts on behalf of my artist. I would never let my artist.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You wouldn't be much of a manager if you didn't.
But in terms of my relationship with the artist, they were always free to leave.
Yeah.
They didn't have to call a lawyer.
Really?
Yeah. So, which really changed the nature of the relationship.
Yeah.
So they really, instead of feeling like an indentured servant, they appreciated the work you did for them.
Yeah, and they were always with you by choice.
By choice, not by, because they had to be, which psychologically is gigantic. And I used to tell all my clients that, you know, one of the reasons that I don't really want a contract is I need to fail. You need to allow me to fail. And if you think I'm this perfect person who signs a contract, that's not what you're going to get. Life doesn't work that way. So it just changed the nature of the relationship.
Now, have you ever regretted not having a contract with a client?
Yes, in my later years, I have regretted it. Because along with the contract goes the cash flow for the work you've done. And I do have some artists who, even though they're not obligated, continue to pay me. Really? For the work I did. But I've never asked for it, and I don't know. Although I think that a manager deserves it if they do a good job on a particular piece of product. It was a flaw in my system, having never been to it before.
Because, you know, if you don't have a contract and they leave you as a client, then you get cut out of all those royalties.
Which
that
is fair.
A manager should be entitled
which
to,
I think
usually.
I think that's fair? I think for the most part it's fair, but I think that if a manager had a significant effect, for example, Alice and I with Schools Out, the album. I was a significant player. I wasn't someone that he brought the album into and said, put this out.
Yeah.
You deserve your piece.
Yeah, and you talk a lot about creating win-win situations in business.
Very important. Compassion. I call it compassionate business. And I think it's, again, as I would tell my clients, it's the most selfish thing you can do is try and leave the person in a negotiation feeling that they like you, that you are fair with them. Because every career, particularly in show business, will have hills and valleys. And when you've taken advantage of the person for an extra nickel that you're going to blow anyway, they're going to be waiting for you with a baseball bat. And if you helped them and gave them that extra nickel, which you would have thrown probably into cocaine or some stupid thing anyway, they're going to be there to pick you up and support you. And so it's very selfish. It's also the right way to live. It's the right thing to do. It's what a man should do. Is, you know, don't look to squeeze somebody because you have the advantage.
Yeah, which must be kind of unusual in Hollywood and in the music industry where everyone's trying to screw you.
Well, I think 90% of the people who do what I do think short term. They don't believe they're going to be with the artist. If you look at the history of artists and their representatives, they're usually short-term affairs.
Yeah.
They're usually 4 years, 5 years. Alice, I've managed 47 years now.
Wow.
Teddy Pendergrass was 20 years.
Wow.
Luther Vandross was 20. I was a long-term player. I wasn't there for the next day.
Yeah.
I think there'd be plenty more to divide up.
There's one story that I think says a lot about how you operate. I guess Tom Arnold, the actor Tom Arnold, had this paparazzo who was bothering him in Hawaii, and I guess 2 years in a row took some unflattering photo of him on the beach with his shirt off and put it on and sold
it
to
research.
People or something like that. And he turned to you because you live there and you know everyone on the island. And you reached out to the photographer and convinced him to stop bothering Tom and leave him alone on the beach. And what's amazing is now, if you watch the documentary about you, Supermensch, both Tom and the paparazzi photographer have nothing but amazing things to say about you. How the hell do you turn into a win-win?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm going to use that because it's hard for me sometimes to think of examples of win-win when people ask me. And that's a great example. You did great research. But what happened was, there was a mounting problem. One of the beautiful things about Maui is we didn't have paparazzi. When I moved to Maui, you know, paparazzi is a new phenomenon.
Yeah.
When I moved to Maui, it didn't exist. And then over time, it became a deterrent from people coming back to Maui. There would always be a paparazzi staying at the Four Seasons. But I wasn't involved because it was none of my artists. Nobody asked me to help. I just let it go by.
And they have easy access through the beach,
Very easy
too.
Access. One of the things I love about Hawaii is that all the beaches are public. And you have to provide public access. And that's our strength. I would fight anyone hard who tried to stop that. And that's the way that most of the artist representatives went. They would call the hotel. The hotel security would come and hassle these kids who were paparazzis that they couldn't be on the lawn. They'd go to the police. The police would show up. It wasn't Maui. It wasn't the way it should be. That's not what we're about. So when Tom brought the situation up to me, I said, I can make this work. This is just someone who wants to make it work. So I went to the paparazzi guys and I said, if I was to provide for you a valuable artist whose pictures are worth money, who would allow you to shoot him and approve one picture that you could have exclusive rights to sell, would you agree to do that? And would you donate 50% of your money, because I'm going to make it easy for you. You're not going to have to find them. We're going to find you. 50% of your money to the Maui Food Bank.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that part.
And Derek, who sort of was the lead paparazzi on the island, because we only had three or four of this. Some would fly in if it was a big enough star, but he was able to corral them. And we made a great deal, and it existed until he moved away from the island 2 years ago, about a year and a half ago.
Wow.
Every artist that came through that I knew, if they called me and I called him first, that was our deal. If I called him first... Nobody got bothered.
Yeah, he loves you now.
Yeah, well, he made a lot of money.
Yeah.
He had easy access. They became friends. I think, you know, a lot of these artists actually called Derek when they used to come to town. They go to dinner with him. He's a very nice guy. And truthfully, press is what we all live on.
Yeah.
So if we can find somebody friendly who gets it, who can make the money off selling the picture, but also allows us to get the picture we want out there.
Yeah.
It's a win-win situation.
There you go. Well, is this what you call a coupon?
So I wouldn't say there's too many coupons, because I'm giving the coupons as it happens.
Yeah.
For me, a coupon would be more if I went to the paparazzi and I said, listen, man, you got to bury those pictures. And he buried them. And then I go to the artist and say, you now owe me a coupon. I got the pictures buried. But this was a fair exchange.
Yeah.
And it's really selfish. For the artist, they have a great time instead of being paranoid and looking around the corner. For Derek, instead of feeling like a jerk for invading someone's privacy, because he's a nice man, he just happens to make his living that way.
Yeah.
He feels like a human.
Yeah. You know, I want to go all the way back here. Your career has had so many unexpected turns that you probably never imagined. Unlike so many people, you did not come out to Los Angeles to break into the movie business or get into rock and roll originally. What is it that brought you here?
I came here to be a probation officer. I worked at Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall in the California penal system. But I worked for one day. It was the only thing shorter than my managing Pink Floyd.
Why only one day?
It was a Reagan era. For those of you who don't remember what that was like, it was very oppressive. If you had long hair and you drove down Sunset Boulevard, you were up against the building at one point of the night with a policeman searching you. There was no doubt about it. It was really, they wanted the hippies out of here.
Yeah.
And I was a hippie, long hair from New York, who... thought he was going to save the kids. It was like on a white horse coming in. And I got to Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall. It was mostly Latino kids, 13, 14, 15, 16. And the guard sent me out to play softball with the kids. And I sort of became the baseball. And I realized immediately the guards they hated me more than they hated the kids in the prison.
Yeah.
So I quit the first night and drove into Hollywood. I had never been to Hollywood. Checked into a motel and heard someone screaming and thought someone was getting raped, because I had just come from a jail, so I had a very ugly thought.
Yeah, your defenses were up.
And me and my partner, Joe Greenberg, we sort of separated them, and I got punched by the girl saying, we're making love, you are a jerk. So twice in a day I'm beat up. It's my first week or day in L.A. And it was Janis Joplin.
Wow.
And the hotel was filled with all these rock icons, Jimi Hendrix and the Chambers Brothers and Jim Morrison. And my life began. Chambers Brothers and Jimi Hendrix said, are you Jewish? And I said, yeah. And they said, you should be a manager. And Alice Cooper, they hooked me up with. And 47 years later, we played the Fantasias 2 nights ago.
And that was your first client.
That was my first
Alice
client.
Cooper.
Yeah, that will be my last.
Yeah. Is that hotel still, that motel
it is still there?
What is it, the Landmark Motel?
It was a Hollywood Landmark. I forgot what it's called now. It's the first driveway west of the Magic Castle.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So it's
okay.
Right there between Highland and La Brea.
Okay.
And it still looks exactly the same.
Really?
Yeah. But the name has changed.
Yeah. I mean, you must look back and think, wow, how did I luck out
just, oh my God,
you know, stumbling into this motel, you know, the first day I've been in LA.
Anthony Bourdain, and I tell them, and in there I talk about how lucky I am. And my whole life, I mean, I realize that it's hard work. I don't want to be silly and say that it's just luck.
Yeah.
But luck played an unbelievable role in my life in so many ways, and that was certain. You know, I could have checked into any motel.
The Alice Cooper Band was known for their theatricality. Most famously, there was the chicken incident or stunt. You were the mastermind behind a bunch of stunts when you were trying to get the band attention in the early days. Was there one that was you were particularly proud of?
There were a lot of them. You know, I was the desperate manager behind the trying to get attention. And we realized the way we could get attention, as opposed to getting records on the radio, was by irritating parents. That when you had a name like Alice Cooper and you're wearing dresses and your hair down to your waist, you can irritate parents. And if you irritate parents, you turn on children.
Right, like Elvis.
Like Elvis.
Or the Beatles.
Or the Beatles. And any of the big icons, if you look at them, what they had in common was hatred of parents. Matter of fact, we did a talk last night, and two of the people in the talk got up and talked about how their parents came in when they were listening to Alice Cooper and turned it off the radio and grounded them. And that's perfect for us, getting banned in a city. So I think some of our great stunts were we got to London. We hadn't sold a lot of tickets. People didn't really know who Alice was. We thought they did. And it gave us that moment where we could define Alice. And our definition was something that parents would hate. So how do we get parents really fast to hate Alice Cooper? They don't listen to the radio, so it's not going to be a record. They don't read Rolling Stone, it's not going to be Rolling Stone. How do I get that parent over a breakfast table to say to their kid, hey, if you go see that guy Alice Cooper next week, you're grounded for a month. If I can get the parent to say that, I've won the game, because they're going to figure out how to get to the concert.
Yeah.
And I asked some people when I got there, and it turned out that BBC Morning TV was what all the, had the biggest ratings in England, and that BBC Morning TV showed basically two things, the weather and traffic. And I said, I can't affect the weather, but I can definitely affect traffic. And they used to have helicopters flying around town showing the highway. So I built a 40-foot billboard of Alice naked with a snake wrapped around his genitals and put on Wembley Stadium the date, and broke it down at Piccadilly Circus during rush hour in the morning twice.
Oh, you paid the guy to break down in the middle of Piccadilly Circus?
Twice, and paid him to go to jail, which he did for a couple
really?
Of weeks. Yeah. And the same bobbies came over. It got so mad the second time. It was like, we just got you out of here. But it backed up traffic for 30 miles. It caused, that afternoon, in a session of Parliament, two ministers, Leo Apps and Sir Mary Whitehouse, Lady Mary Whitehouse, put in a bill to ban Alice from coming to England, which hit the front pages the next day with the picture of the billboard. And we were home. We sold out the show in 1 minute. And
wow. Yeah, do you ever think about taking it in front of Buckingham Palace?
We thought about it. We actually tried to double up the next year.
See if you get the Queen to come to the window.
We tried, We thought about it. We never did it.
Well, you're a man who has a reputation for going all the way above and beyond for his clients. What were some of the other tricks of the trade that you used to get your clients' attention over the years?
I think for each one, I tried to create brands that had a bigger appeal than them, to get them into a wave that was bigger than them. So for Teddy Pendergrass, for example, sex was really what he was about. It was different than romance. Luther Vandross was romance. You know, invite your girl you love to dinner, light some candles, have a violin player. That was Luther. Teddy was go to a bar, see a chick across the way, grab her hair, drag her to your bedroom.
Like Trump.
Yeah, like Trump. Yeah. Drag her to your bedroom, you know. And so how do you say that without being arrogant and stupid? Yeah. And so what I did was for women-only concerts. I only allowed women into Teddy's concerts. We did five of them.
And you sold enough seats?
Yeah, we sold out. Oh, it was gigantic. We gave out chocolate teddy bear lollipops that they licked on during the show just to really drive the point of sex. This was not about being not, you know. And for Luther, who I had to define also, but was of romance, I ran a contest in the 20 biggest radio stations in America where you could get married on air by Luther. Every girl cried listening to those radio shows.
Was he a licensed minister?
No, he did the music. A minister came on, and they chose who married him. But he sang at the wedding song for him. And Luther became, for many years, the most played artist at weddings.
I love that.
So it's really it's that same theory that I used with the paparazzi.
Yeah.
It's win-win.
How do I make...
The girls at those Teddy shows, when they were licking on the lollipops, that's the happiest they've ever been in their lives. They were in an environment. We gave them a safe environment without their boyfriends to get wet in their seats over Teddy. Because they couldn't take their boyfriend and scream, "Oh, Teddy, I love you." So we created the perfect environment for it.
You know, and early in managing Teddy Pendergrass, you were introduced to the notorious institution for black performers called the Chitlin Circuit. Yeah. And I think you would probably be credited with rebelling against that and perhaps helping to dismantle it. What was the Chitlin Circuit?
Chitlin Circuit really exists in every single artistic form at some point or another. In the Afro-American world, it was called the Chitlin Circuit. It existed with the chefs. It exists with the artists, painting artists. I get calls from now about help us like you did the other guys. And basically what it is that artists create content. Normally, other people monetize that content so that the artist is not the person getting the original check. When I say that, you cook in a kitchen, someone comes to a restaurant, the restaurant owner gets the money. That money, then he decides how much you get out of it. You're at his discretion. In the entertainment business, you go to play a club. You can play the same club for nothing, or you can play that same club for $1 million. It's a negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
But you as the artist on the stage are not going to touch the money first. There's going to be somebody who collects. So as artists, you are very vulnerable to the intentions and the organizations around you. And what always happens is that the people who you give your content to, in the case of chefs who was restaurant owners, in the case of the black artists, it was the record companies, who they would give their, they'd sing, it would become a record, that record would get sold, the company would decide how much the person singing and writing got, because they got the money first.
Yeah.
And in every art form, those guys would get greedy.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go around and make these collective decisions with everyone else who collected the money. Of let's screw the artist. So in the Chitlin circuit, how it was the record companies who went to the radio stations who they needed to play their records to sell their records and said, I can get you all the artists that have number one records on my label to work your club for free if you continue to play the record. The record company never got revenue from the dates, so they didn't care if they were giving the artist away for free. The artist is the content provider. He's a victim. So the record company comes to the artist and says, if you don't play this club for free, you're never going to get another record on the air. You have to play it for free.
Yeah.
Same thing with the chefs.
It's like an indentured servant.
Same thing with art. Right now, the standard in art is the art galleries take 60-70%.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Because as an artist, you can't get to your people. Someone else collects the money first.
Is that something that you're working on now?
Not at all.
But it's something you've noticed.
Yeah. So when I got to the chefs, for example, it was exactly the same system. They were convinced that they had to go work at other restaurants, provide content. So Wolfgang would go to, let's say, the Hilton Hotel in Virginia. They do a Wolfgang Puck night. They wouldn't pay him, but he was convinced the only way he was going to sell tickets at his restaurant was to go. They convinced all the artists, like playing the nightclubs for free. So it's the same. It's historically in every art form. And in the Chitlin circuit, it was difficult because gallery owners don't normally have guns. The Afro-American world, violence is, and the record business was big economics.
Yeah. So you could have gotten bumped off for
messing
with this
Teddy's
system.
Last manager was shot to death.
Jesus.
it was pretty. I had guns put to my head a few times in the escapade. But again, there was enough for all.
Yeah.
And that's how I resolved it finally.
A win-win. Everyone gets
finally resolved it. We hit a point where it got really ugly.
Yeah.
Like really ugly. Picketing Teddy shows, people coming to my office, pistol whipping people. Jeez. It got ugly. And finally, we made a deal. And the deal was that we were going to get paid. We were going to get paid by white promoters. And we would force the white promoter to give the Chitlin Circuit promoter some money.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with Shep Gordon when we come back in just a minute. If you're interested in my conversation with Shep Gordon, you should check out his new book, They Call Me Supermensch, a backstage pass to the amazing worlds of film, food, and rock and roll, by my guest today, Shep Gordon. And right now, you can download the audio version of his book for free with a special promotion just for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be They Call Me Supermensch by Shep Gordon or any of Audible's 180,000 titles. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show.
You've seen so many of your clients and friends in the business self-destruct. It must be a strange position when you have people who are paying you to attain that thing that you know from experience has the potential to ultimately destroy them, fame.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Have you ever sat a client down and said, you know, this thing that you're chasing that you want so badly, probably, you know, it isn't what you think it is. This isn't going to be the answer to your problems. If anything, you're probably going to have more problems.
Yeah. I never started working with an artist that I didn't make him sit at my desk. In those days, I wore glasses before LASIK surgery, and I would take off my glasses. And I would look him in the eye and I'd say, I know you're going to laugh, but this is really serious. If I do my job perfectly, I will probably kill you. But I'm not perfect. But I'm really good. So I will maim you.
Yeah.
If you're willing to get maimed to get what you want, which is fame, I can get you the fame. But it's going to hurt.
Yeah.
And hopefully you'll survive it.
Yeah.
And I'll be with you the whole way through to help you through it. But
wow.
It was a heavy, I think when Teddy's accident happened, that was when I sort of decided I didn't want to be a part of that circle anymore. But it was my skill set. It was what I did well. I convinced myself, whether true or not, that they were going to pursue their dream anyway. And at least I was an honest guy who could help them.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't as if I walked out, they were going to give up.
Yeah.
They'd probably go get ripped off somewhere and really hurt.
Yeah.
So I convinced myself it was okay to do it.
Yeah, I think you said something. You said fame has no intrinsic value.
Yeah, it has no intrinsic value at all.
It's really,
I always think of it, you know, my vision of fame is the sword in Star Wars that you have to hold with two hands of lights.
Yeah.
And it's so powerful.
Yeah, you got to hold on to it.
You got to hold on to it. And mm-hmm. You know, that's my vision of fame.
Well, yeah. And, you know, speaking of fame, there was a movie called Almost Famous. And supposedly the plane scene from that movie, the Cameron Crowe movie, was based on something that happened when you and Alice Cooper and the band were traveling on the road.
I just saw, really funny, the Cameron Crowe, who directed and wrote Almost Famous, was, I think, 17 or 18. And he came on the road with us to do a story for Rolling Stone that Candice Bergen was a photographer on. And we had chartered this horrible twin-engine plane way before people were chartering because we wanted to come into a city and have Alice Cooper's name on a plane with a snake and really get parents pissed off that we had enough money to do that. But it was a horrible plane. You used to have to put oil in to get the tires down and stuff. It was horrible. And we had an accountant who just came. Anthony Bourdain published my book. And we did a speech together in New York at the 92nd Street Y. And after the thing, there was a book signing party. And the guy in the movie, in real life, whose name was Jay, he was our accountant. We called him Elton Jew because he wore big glasses and he was the accountant. His wife had just gotten pregnant. He had found that about 3 days before this incident happened. And at the show, we all had a toast to him and his family. And we laughed about, wait a second, you can't pot. You're Elton Jew. You can't even get hard. Whose baby is this? It became like the joke of whose baby is this? And Alice is playing poker, and he says, I think we should double the odds. And everyone said, why? And he said, because the engine's on fire. Oh, and we looked at it. The engine was on fire. So this guy, Space Latanza, stands up in the back of the plane, and he says, well, I guess we're going to die. I got to tell the truth. Elton, it's my baby.
Oh, wow.
And with that, the plane, the fire goes out. And that's exactly the scene Cameron wrote. But I saw Elton Jew at the book signing party, which was unbelievable. It's the first time I've seen him since that tour.
How's his kid?
The kid's old. His kid went to college. It's like hysterical.
Oh, my Lord. Who was the biggest diva?
Yeah, Luther was a diva.
Yeah.
Yeah, Luther was definitely a diva. And he had a right to be. He was an amazing artist.
Yeah.
Really remarkable artist.
Yeah.
Soup to nuts artist. He produced his records. He wrote the songs. He produced every second of the stage show, down to the stitching on the costumes. He was really remarkable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At a certain point, you decided to bust into the film business. And am I right that you would probably have had one of the first independent film companies, pre-Miramax?
I think we were the first
American.
Other
than maybe Roger Corman.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, Roger Corman was, absolutely. There was Roger Corman. There was a couple of other very, very, very low budget, non-artistic orientated films. Exploitation movies. Those black exploitation.
Right.
What we did in America was we loved the European model. And the European model was allowing artists to make movies that were passionate to them and weren't necessarily movies by committee, not action movies. But nobody was doing it in America.
Yeah.
And there was no outlet for these French movies in America and these worldwide movies. And we started a small company called Alive Films. And I think the first film we did was Stop Making Sense, and then Koyaanisqatsi, and Kiss of the Spider Woman, and all the Alan Rudolph movies.
Mm-hmm.
El Norte, which was an amazing piece. El Norte was, when Sundance first opened, it wasn't a film festival. It was a laboratory to create product, sponsored by Robert Redford.
Yeah.
But it was an educational institution, and the first script that came out of that Sundance was called El Norte by Gregory Naver, and we produced and distributed that movie.
Wow.
And then did a lot of really nice art movies, won a couple of Academy Awards with it.
Yeah.
Had a good run.
Yeah.
Did Ridley Scott's first movie, The Duelist.
That's right. Yeah, that was his and your first movie,
yeah, that
right?
That was my first movie and his first movie.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because, like I said, your life has had so many unexpected twists and turns. And of course, going into the film business led you to Cannes, and Cannes led you to a very important person in your life, the late, great Michelin-starred chef, Roger Verger, who you met when you were there for the film festival. You said that he changed your life. What did he do for you?
Yeah, he was really the first person that I was attracted to who was very successful and happy.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't seen those two qualities in people. The people that I were meeting who were very successful had a surface happiness, but it wasn't based on what I thought were long-lasting, healthy values.
Mm-hmm.
They were fool's gold in every part of their life. The table they sat at was important. They'd get angry if they weren't at the right table. The car they drove was important. They'd ridicule people who weren't driving like great cars. It was success was unbelievable. Beating people was they weren't the ones that were more powerful were more into it. And although their face might have had a smile, you could just see there was no joy at all. They just weren't happy. And I realized I was sort of becoming one of them. I had the white Rolls Royce. I had the rings on. You know, I had the Playboy girls, I had a nightclub. I was way too young, way too successful, but something inside of me said, wow, are you in trouble? Although I didn't talk about it or see it, I knew that I was at risk. And around me, so many people were dying. Jimi Hendrix dead, Janis Joplin dead, all these people. And then he walked into this room, and I could see he was happy to the bone.
Wow.
I just was attracted, and I was very aggressive with him, and he was really nice. He allowed me to become part of his life.
Yeah, and you kind of became a food. Were you a foodie before?
Not at all. I was a macaroni and ketchup guy.
Yeah.
but I asked him how I could spend some time with him, and he said, yeah. Learn to cook.
Yeah.
So I developed the thing. And then by being around him, I didn't realize that he was even a chef. But once I started to get a few years into it, I started to see what an amazing artist he was.
Mm-hmm.
And how his artistry was very similar to the people I represented. They had to create new recipes. They had to create new songs. They had to give the hits. Like Alice always had to play 18. Mr. Roget always had to do a zucchini flower. They wore street clothes during the day. They changed at night into their performance.
Mm-hmm.
Alice put on his costume. Roget put on his whites. They'd be backstage giving notes. For Roget, maybe it was the souffle was too high. Or for Alice, it would be, could simplify that guitar part tonight. It was, and then they go out on stage with a smile, meet their audience, do their show.
Yeah.
And I'm going to start again the next day.
Yeah, you know, last week I had Mario Batali on.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
And we were talking.
I managed Mario for a while.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay. Yeah, and he was talking about how, you know, we forget that in those days, cooking was not a respectable profession. That was what you did between getting out of the army and going to prison.
Yeah.
You worked as a cook.
No, absolutely. No, my first, I love Mario. I think he's amazingly talented, great guy. We had a couple of rough years, which were really funny, and it's so typical in the world of artists. When I started working with everyone, they weren't making anything.
I mean, they were getting treated anything. Like crap, you said.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, nothing. If Mario Batali made $55,000, $50,000, I don't mean to denigrate $50,000, but compared to what they make today.
Yeah.
And what I was trying to do with the artists was, what I tried to explain to them was that before record players, before radio stations, before acetates, Michael Jackson would have been a wandering minstrel.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you guys are. So what you need to do is exactly what he did and every other artist is develop ways to reach your audience when they're not in your living room.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant the Food TV network. That meant pots and pans. That meant books. That meant videos. As part of that, I wanted to develop a system where they could get a royalty for their recipes, like Alice got a royalty for his songs, where if other people use them, they would have to pay. And I also wanted to make the point, just like with Alice, you go into a jukebox and there's Alice, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, that they are an important addition to other money-making ventures. So one of the things, I got called by the Rainforest Cafe, who looked like they were exploding at the time, and about helping them. And what I did, again, a win-win, was I got a celebrity chef caption on their menus, and I got Mario Batali to do one dish, Kerry Simon to do one dish, and Larry Forgione to do one dish, get a royalty for the dish. I got him, as I recall, $125,000 for the recipe each.
Wow.
And a royalty. Now, you have to remember, these guys had never made over $55,000 a year.
Yeah.
This was one recipe, 3 hours of work.
Wow.
So Mario did it, got his $125,000, and for 2 or 3 years would not forgive me, would just beat the crap out of me. Don't you have any respect? How could you put me in a rainforest cafe?
Oh, he's pretty forgiving, I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, I guess all the chefs at one point, it's like they had this mafia meeting where Wolfgang Puck invited you to lunch, and there were, a dozen different, what we now consider
45,
celebrity chefs who were saying, help us, us, chef. No, 40, we're getting screwed left and right. They were getting stiffed, doing these junkets.
Just like the Chitlin'
Circuit.
Stiffed. Same thing as exactly the Chitlin' Circuit. So for me, it was when they said it wasn't, although on the outside it looked like, oh my God, how are you going to do that? To me, it was very logical.
Yeah.
I knew what I had to do. I had to get the money to go to their hand first. I had to develop systems that they could reach and touch their audience. And I had to get broadcast, because broadcast would make them famous.
Yeah.
And that was the Food Network.
Yeah, yeah. And you managed, I think you said it, at the peak of your culinary enterprise, 100 of pretty much every top chef that everyone knows today.
Yeah.
And you also, you yourself became kind of a lover of cooking and
I'm
food.
I'm very passionate.
Under Roger.
I came back last week. I went white truffle hunting all last week in Alba, Italy.
Oh, nice. That's got to be fun.
With dogs. It was really fun.
Now, how did you come to cook for the Dalai Lama? How does one get a gig cooking for the Dalai Lama?
I got invited to see him in L.A. by Sharon Stone. And when I got back to Hawaii, he was doing a speech on the Big Island. And I made an offering of doing his food while he was on the Big Island. They accepted it. And we got along great. And I traveled to Trinidad and prepared his food for him there. And went to New York. And then he asked me to join his board, which I did for the last 20 years or so.
Wow.
So I stopped cooking. I haven't cooked for him in 20 years. But I go, I go to the board meetings.
And, okay. You even procured yak butter.
Yeah.
For his visit.
That was the only staple in Tibet was yak. which is like a cross between a goat and a cow, maybe. And they have yak cheese, yak butter, yak tea, which they make out of the yak butter. So I thought I was doing a great thing. I sent someone in who smuggled yak butter out and up Tibet and had it in my house. It smelled up the whole house. It was the most rancid smelling stuff. And when His Holiness came the first morning, I served them yak tea, which I was very proud of, that I had worked so hard. He looked at me, he was brushing his teeth, and he goes, yak tea? And I said, yes, Your Holiness. And he started giggling, and he said, oh, that's why I leave Tibet. It smelled so bad.
Yeah, and it sounds like he's another one of these people who became an important influence on your life.
Yeah.
What did you learn or what did you get from your encounters with the
same
Dalai
exact
Lama?
Thing as Mr. Verger.
Yeah.
They lived what we all know. Mm-hmm. Which is be of service, be compassionate, love everything.
Mm-hmm.
All those things you hear as a kid and you sort of throw away, they live by.
Yeah.
And service probably number one.
Yeah.
As they both had demonstrated, it's like the most selfish thing you can do.
Yeah.
Because you become so happy.
Yeah.
It's weird. It may not compute on paper, but it
comes back to you.
But it's real.
Yeah.
You
say that you're thankful every day. You say thank you for something. A few things to say thank you for.
Absolutely.
That's a good way to start
your day.
And every night,
although
too.
It was hard coming through Halloween traffic last night.
Yeah, not much to be thankful for. Well, I'm curious, what kind of music do you listen to nowadays? Do you still find yourself listening to an artist and thinking, whoa, there's some potential here. If only they would do this instead of this.
No, not at all.
You're out of the business, you stop.
Never really was a music guy. I listened to the ocean.
Yeah. Okay.
Haven't had a stereo in my house for probably 30 years.
Yeah.
Rick Rubin came over and wanted to play me something. I said, I don't have a stereo. Only put Sonos in my house, which was really nice of him.
Yeah.
And I listened to Teddy Pendergrass' Pandora on it.
Oh, okay. But you're a Pandora guy.
That's about
not
it.
Not a Spotify guy?
Yeah, he didn't put that on my computer. So. I'm not really... Music or movies were never really my passion.
Yeah.
They were the way I made my living.
Yeah.
It's what my artist did.
Yeah.
I never went to the studio.
Okay.
I don't think I... If in my whole life I spent 2 hours in a recording studio, added up, that would be gigantic.
Yeah.
Only when Faust went to a movie set.
Yeah.
Never read the scripts.
Okay.
Trusted the artist.
Okay.
You know, my movies were artist-oriented. I did 5 with Alan Rudolph, a couple with Sam Shepard, a couple with Wes Craven.
Right. You kind of got talked into coming into the business.
Yeah, it wasn't my choice. But I was happy I did it. But I foresaw my role not as a filmmaker, but as a protector of the artist creating the film.
Yeah.
As I always did with all my artists, you know, more of a protector. The guy on the white horse coming in to save the day.
Well, if those things aren't the most fulfilling things in your life, what does bring you happiness these days?
Golfing, really fun. Cooking, my number one passion. My kids and grandkids, hanging out with them, which is great. A lot of them back on Maui. I'm pretty happy every day. I'm pretty lucky. I find stuff every day to get really happy about.
Yeah. Well, like I said, you are universally well-liked by people who know you. Is there anyone in the world who thinks... Shep Gordon, that guy's a real asshole.
I'm sure. I am sure there are many. Yes.
And don't tell me. It's the Dalai Lama, right?
No. There'll be one or two who read the book who won't have the fondest words to say about me.
Okay. Well, not many. And the ones who love you, they speak loudly and clearly about you.
I'm very proud of the path I carved through this planet.
Yeah. Again, the book is called They Call Me Supermensch, A Backstage Pass to the Amazing Worlds of Film, Food, and Rock and Roll. I appreciate your sitting down with me. You've got a coupon from me.
Thank you. Thank you.
May not
thank
have
you.
Much value.
Yeah, I'm sure it does.
It has about as much clout as an expired coupon from Burger King.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It
thank
was a
you.
Great chat.
Have a great day.
What a great guy. Now you see why they call him Supermensch. Thanks again to Shep Gordon for joining me. If you enjoyed today's podcast, then you can order his new book, They Call Me Supermensch, A Backstage Pass to the Amazing Worlds of Film, Food, and Rock and Roll on Amazon. Or you can download the audio version for free through a special trial offer just for our listeners at audibletrial.com/kickassnews. And follow Shep Gordon on Twitter at @supermenschshep. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter @KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickassnews. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.